Welcome to the Deep Dives podcast here on the No Ceilings NBA podcast feed. I'm your host, Nick Agar-Johnson. And after a long hiatus, Stephen Gillespie is finally back in the building. Stephen, how are you doing this fine evening?
Nick, it's great. Like, I really feel like I'm at home now. You know, I've been doing a couple episodes of Draft Sickos, but one of my favorite parts of the year, and I said it all year long while I was here, man, it's like, it's awesome that I get to do as much work with you now as I have been lately. So definitely feels like I'm more at home now that I'm on the Deep Dive show as your guest, man. Appreciate you having me on.
Man, you got to butter me up to start. It's just, you're going too far. You leave me in the lurch. I don't know where to go from there. Like, what am I supposed to say? Thank you. I really appreciate the kind words.
You're welcome for being on the show tonight, man. No problem.
Perfect. See, now we're back in the right rhythm. So today we're talking about your article that went up yesterday by the time people are listening to this on Peyton Sanford out of Iowa. And I do want to start with where you start with the piece, which is essentially talking about this draft class and trying to evaluate prospects for this draft class. And this is going to be particularly fascinating for me to get your thoughts because you've been, you know, getting back into the game now, but out of the game for a while. And this class raises, I think, a more complicated sort of production over potential question than many draft classes in the past. I mean, you lead with the 2024 draft class has been projected to be a historic one and not in a good way, right? And so this sort of leads me to a conversation that I've had on this feed numerous times, but is always, I think, an interesting one to go back to of the sort of production versus potential. And so I'm curious sort of what your thoughts are just on this class in general before we dive specifically into Peyton Sanford and sort of the weighing of the scales between how much you're thinking about production for these prospects versus their potential to be something more.
Yeah, it's interesting, Nick. You know, I left at late December. We pretty much just call it January, right? Because I was a couple of days left in the month of December is when I left for the nature of my job. And then I came back a couple of weeks ago and, you know, I've steadily been plugging away at the film. I kind of prioritize in a lot of ways, Nick. I feel like I'm looking at these players for the first time because you know how much happens between the month of January to March in a typical draft cycle. You know, there's going to be players that stay that you're just sure based on the class that they're going to be in a certain range. And then there's always going to be some surprisers and late risers. There's going to be the disappointments. There's going to be the, how long do you hold on to a freshman prospect to where they turned around, a la like Jared McCain, for example, was one of those players this year, right? Or when do you kind of cut ties with a guy that because they don't feel like they're going to be a this year prospect, you know, and there's a few freshman players like I know Marco Jackson out of Kansas had a lot of fans coming into the year and don't really hear his name much anymore, especially out of Kansas when they've brought in a couple of more proven commodities in and maybe he transfers, maybe he doesn't. But back to the whole point of this, Nick, is I come back to this draft class and there were like 12 names that I had that at the top of my board. And I've talked about this a couple of times on, you know, Draft Sickos, and now here with you, those 12 names essentially stayed the same. And then I started looking at the players that were getting a lot of buzz, you know, and so as I'm kind of like reprioritizing my board and like who I want to watch and things like that, I found myself thinking that because the top of this class is lacking the evident star power, right? Like there's no prospect that everyone is saying, hey, this is the top guy. Because there's so much uncertainty at the top as to who is the runaway favorite, and even like towards the tail end of the lottery, like there's a perceived drop off in talent, right? So with that, the name of the game right now, as far as everywhere that I'm seeing, Nick, is that you have to stick with a player who's got a proven skill, you know, an NBA level skill. And that's what led me to wanting to write about Peyton Sanford is because this young man is one of the best, if not the best shooting prospects in the entire class. Right. So we know that spacing and pacing and, you know, offense is at a premium in the NBA. So obviously this guy should be a top prospect in this class. Right. But it got me thinking that it's just really weird. It's almost seems counterintuitive the more that I think about it, Nick. It's like, if the top of this class is lacking star power, why are we holding on to what we're deeming as safer prospects with like one good skill, as opposed to why are we not talking about other prospects who have higher potential, players that are creative with the ball in their hand? Like Hunter Salas is, when I came back, he was, I think he's like 21st on my board right now. And that's not a popular thing. That's not me trying to be contrarian, but it's like, there's not a lot of prospects outside the lottery that can create with the ball in their hand and that have like the level of athleticism that he does. But consensus right now is telling you that he is not a safe prospect. So you're not supposed to take him in the back half of the first round in this year's class. You're better off kind of like swinging on him in the second, right? So with that being said, Nick, it got me thinking that this whole production versus potential, it's not a unique philosophy to think about, but it just seems like in like take next year's class, for example, Nick, you know, I mean, there's Cooper Flagg, Ace. There's a lot of players that, you know, the guys just got done seeing at the Hoop Summit drink, you know,
there we go.
The guys just got done seeing a lot of top prospects, and in classes that are deep with top tier talent, it seems like we get drunk on potential. We get drunk on the idea of players, and you got to go swinging a little bit, which to me, it's like, that seems backwards from what it should be. And, you know, I'm not unique in thinking like this, I'm sure, but it was just something that I found myself thinking about a lot. The more that I look at players in this class, it's like, why are we holding on to quote unquote safe players in a perceived weak draft class, as opposed to if it's weak anyway, so why not go for home run swings? You know what I mean? So that was just something that kind of popped out to me upon my reemergence into the draft scene.
Yeah, it's interesting. I have, I think, a slightly different perspective on it, especially with this year's draft class, which is, you know, if we're talking about sort of quote unquote historically weak draft classes, like the first one that comes to mind is the 2000 draft, which was all time terrible. Like they had three all-stars in the class, and one of them was Jamal McGlure, who was one of the most questionable all-star selections we've had in the last 20 years, right? So it's like, okay.
Sure.
But in that draft class, Jamal Crawford went eighth, right? Michael Redd went, you know, he was one of the all-stars, and he was the only guy who got an all-NBA selection. And if he, you know, what if he didn't have the injuries that he had, he probably would have been the, you know, highlight star from that class. You can, it's a debate between whether it's him or Kenyon Martin, right? But if Redd had been healthy throughout his career, it almost certainly would have been him. But, you know, I guess what I'm getting at here is, you know, the 2013 class, which is, you know, the previous sort of, I guess, slightly more modern era, terrible draft class. And, you know, that was when Anthony Bennett went one. And I thought it was ridiculous that Victor Oladipo didn't go one. And, you know, history proved me sort of right. But what history actually said was, no, the best player in this class went 15th.
Yeah.
Giannis Antetokounmpo. And so
not a safe player, you know,
not a safe pick at all. But, you know, I think it's interesting just in the sense of those are sort of the highlight guys from those classes. But even in the most terrible draft class you can imagine, there are at least a few guys who go on to be, you know, maybe not all-stars, maybe not even starters, but valuable contributing role players for a team. And something that I think about all the time with draft philosophy is there's a very fine sort of, you know, there's the obvious dividing line of the lottery versus the playoff teams, right? And so, you know, then it becomes a question of, generally speaking, if you're drafting in the first half of the first round, unless you're, say, you know, the Oklahoma City Thunder this year, who have everything they could possibly need and will still end up picking in the lottery, unless you're that team, you're almost certainly looking for someone who can be, at the very least, a high caliber starter for your team. Right. And so that's where, okay, you know, if we take a swing and we miss, we're still a bad team. If we take a swing and we hit, maybe we start moving in the right direction. Whereas the flip side of that is if you're looking at the back half of the first round, most of the time, and, you know, again, trades change this, of course, all that, you know, all those caveats that you can throw in. But, you know, if you're picking 27th, you know, 90% of the time, you just need an eighth man. You have your star players, you're a team that's in the upper echelon of playoff competition. You just need one more piece to get you over the line. And so swinging and missing on someone is, you know, oddly maybe more harmful later in the draft because you don't need much, but you need something specific. Whereas earlier in the draft, it's a whole lot of, oh, we need someone who can change our team, right? And so then, you know, the question becomes, if we're talking about the early portion of the draft, you know, just to pick a couple of examples here, you know, maybe a team early on in the draft says, you know what, Dalton Knecht is going to be a very valuable NBA player, but we need the upside swing. We're taking Ron Holland instead. Whereas, yeah, you know, later on, two of the recent deep dives episodes that I did with Rowan, we were talking about two players who I think are on opposite ends of that spectrum that will go later in the first round in Daron Holmes and Isaiah Collier, where if you need the upside swing, Collier makes a ton of sense. But yeah, if you just need a solid rotation big man, I'm much more willing to bet on Daron Holmes. Now, granted, I'm extremely high on Holmes and have been for years now, so maybe that's not the best comparison, but it's more of a sort of philosophy of, if you're picking later in the first round, you know, you not, the odds are not as high that you will need a superstar as it is earlier in the first. And so that's where I come into the conversation with, you know, the guy I always bring up time and time again here. I've brought him up with you before because you made some very insightful comments about him when I brought him up, but Jay Crowder, as someone who, you know, I didn't understand. And this was before I was like really into the draft, but you know, I didn't understand why someone like him, who was an exceptionally successful college player with a very clear, well-rounded skill set, was going early in the second round as opposed to late in the first, because the teams that needed a Jay Crowder type, as has proven the case throughout his NBA career, he's bounced around to a bunch of playoff teams because, you know, teams on the losing end of the spectrum don't necessarily need a guy like him as their eighth man, but a playoff team would love to have Jay Crowder as their eighth man. Yep. And, you know, that sort of, I guess, was foundational in a sense for the draft philosophy for me of, man, if you're picking late in the first round, how many crazy upside swings are really worth it, as opposed to just you need someone specific? A lot of it is, you know, BPA versus fit, right? I think BPA is what you really have to go for at the top of the draft. And then maybe later on in the first round, especially if you're a playoff team picking there, then, you know, it's worth taking someone who you're comfortable with their floor. Now, granted, if you're, I think Utah has one of the late picks that in the first round that they've got in a trade, if I'm remembering correctly, if you're them, maybe that's when you take the swing on a Hunter Salas because, hey, like, we just need guys who can be, you know, high level contributors. And if we swing and miss on Hunter Salas, okay, that sucks, but it's not as big of a deal as we're the fourth seed. We're like the fifth seed. We need to be a home court advantage team. If we take this guy and he flames out, then that's really going to be harmful for our sort of long-term team building.
Yeah. It's so there's a lot that in this conversation, Nick, that you get like these, like, niche philosophy conversations that come out of it where, you know, well, all prospects are swings technically, right? Like there's no such thing as like a guaranteed prospect. And then when you mentioned fit versus BPA, it reminded me of an article and conversation that I know that Rucker and Corey have had for the network, where it's like, okay, you can do fit versus BPA and you just say, well, just take the best player available and figure it out. But if you're deep at that position and you know that rookies take time anyway, especially on the defensive side of the ball for the most part, unless you're Victor Wembanyama and Chet Holmgren,
right?
You know, unless you're those guys, defense is going to kind of wax and wane. And then, you know, there's coaches where if you can't play defense, you're barely going to see the floor. You know, you brought up Denver earlier with Mike Malone. He's definitely one. Coach Thibodeau. There's a lot of coaches that value defense, right? So if you take that quote unquote best player available, and maybe they're the best player available because of the potential or the ceiling they might have, right? So there's like these sub things that all are kind of like baked into a prospect. And if they don't play, then if you, even though you were deep at that position, you took a risk on them and they don't play. Meanwhile, a player that might have fit your team better goes at a different pick that you pass up on, then you got to kind of deal with that. And that's something that front offices unfortunately have to deal with on a game by game basis. You know, it's like, hey, you know, we're reminded all the time of all the teams that passed up on Tyrese Halliburton, and rightfully so, because that was like a historic miss for a lot of teams. But sometimes it's not best player available. Sometimes it's fit. So
yeah, I mean, that's just on that same front
with, oh, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, just very quickly on that same front, I mean, Rucker and I had this exact debate about Jaden Ivey versus Keegan Murray for the Kings, and he was right and I was wrong because he was going with what's actually going to make sense for this team, where I was like, man, the swing on Jaden Ivey could be really huge for them. But, you know, that was a Kings team that at the time was not a playoff team, and now they are, and Keegan Murray was the perfect fit, and he made that lineup make a whole lot more sense and made me feel foolish for thinking, maybe you still go with Jaden Ivey here. Not that Jaden Ivey hasn't looked much better this year, just Keegan Murray is such an exceptionally perfect fit. And ironically, Jaden Ivey is a better fit for the Kings problems this year than the Kings problems last year. But certainly for where the team was last year, Keegan Murray was the guy who slotted in perfectly and did exactly what they needed him to do.
And we talk about it all the time where it's like, you know, you just take the best, you know, it depends on the prospect you like as to which, you know, buzz phrase in the draft community that you decide to use, right? Like, if I like a player and I'm tired of seeing them fall on a mock draft and I take them, you know, the thing that I'm going to say, I'm sure everybody listening right now as I'm kind of leading up into it is trying to guess, and they're probably saying it already. It's like, you just take the best player and then you figure it out later, you know, but there's another saying that that is blank and then find out, right? So that's ultimately what you're saying. When you take the best player available and then figure it out later, you are blanking around and finding out, right?
Wonderfully done. Very, very well done.
And you can find out for the best or for the worst. You know, I mean, that's essentially what you're saying when you say take the best player and figure it out later. You know, so that's the funny thing about the draft as a whole, the draft as in philosophies as a whole. And ultimately, you're just going to pick whichever one that is applicable for your argument. And that's what makes these conversations fun. But front offices, they don't get to just have fun. They get to have fun, but they also get to do that phrase that we just mentioned. So
there you go. Yeah. So let's talk now about how all of this applies specifically to Peyton Sanford, who is the player that you actually wrote about for this article that we're theoretically discussing here. And, you know, Sanford falls into a very clear sort of bucket in the sense of, you know, you mentioned it earlier, right? Of he has a very clearly defined NBA skill. And there's a fascinating discussion that I think has cropped up more over literally just the past two seasons as opposed to, you know, even the past five. Like if you're looking at sort of chunks of time NBA wise, you know, there's a 5-year window, but there's also just year over year. And I think what we've seen in the year over year sense over the past couple of years is players who can only do one thing are slowly getting shuffled to the side. And so then, you know, I think the question for Sanford is, all right, you know, you buy into the concept that this is an elite shooter. Then the question becomes, as you dove into for the article, what else can he do at a high enough level to sort of continue to get playing time on an NBA floor?
Yeah. And kind of one of the paragraphs that I'll pull from the article here that you can get over at NoSailingsNBA.com.
There you go. Perfect plug.
It says, knowing all of this, just kind of summarizing the information that I put out earlier, says it would make sense to draft a 6'7" wing player who shot just under 38% from deep on 7 attempts per game. Yeah. How about one that put those numbers up while shooting over 91% from the free throw line? That's a good touch indicator. Nick, I know that you're a partial free throw shooter, right?
There we go.
And what if these numbers were, what if these numbers were just the tip of the iceberg, right? That's kind of my lead in to the next segment that I'm sure that we'll talk about. But there's a clearly defined player right there, you know, a deadly shooter with good NBA size that can play, you know, everyone will say because he's 6'7", they'll say the 2 through 4. You know, maybe he's more suited as just one position. Maybe he's good at two positions. Maybe he does get to that often thrown out like 2 through 4 position range, you know, and that's where you can kind of get a little bit creative. And, you know, depending on what you want in a player, you'll have to find that. But with the shooting, Nick, as we talk about all the time, you know, you can't just be a shooter. You know, you have to get to that what else. And sometimes that's being good on the defensive side. Sometimes that's being a good connective passer and being a really active team defender. Maybe you're good at rebounding, you know, there's a whole bunch of things that you can be good at. But you have to have something else to complement that shooting.
Yeah. I think there's a, you know, getting into the dive section here, I think there's a very interesting element here as well, which, you know, it's funny, I have thought about quite a bit with Daron Holmes, who I already brought up this year. But the concept of, you know, a player who maybe early on in their college career, they play a role that will end up looking more like their probable NBA role. And yeah. then, you know, years, you know, in Sanford and Holmes's case, years 2 and 3, you know, essentially being, okay, you know, now that I've sort of established this baseline of, you know, what I can be alongside, hey, guy we talked about earlier, Keegan Murray, you know, yeah. what I can be alongside Chris Murray, right? He went from, you know, as you say in the piece, went from role playing freshman to the fourth leading scorer as a sophomore to, you know, really the guy essentially for Iowa this year. And it's an interesting evolution, but it's also, you know, something that gives me a high level of confidence that, okay, you know, it's something that we also talk about all the time, right? The vast majority of NBA players were stars on their college team, were, exactly. you know, clearly stars on their high school team because they were also stars on their college team, right? But being able to scale down from being the man to being a role player at the NBA level is not a transition that everybody can make easily. And so for someone like Sanford, who's already played that kind of role, that's going to be presumably pretty similar to what he does at the NBA level, you know, he's proven that he can be comfortable in a smaller role and be comfortable as an off the bench role playing shooter type. Then, you know, the question becomes, okay, great. He's built on his game from there, right? That's certainly huge from, you know, the developmental standpoint, but realistically, the role that he's going to play at the NBA level is going to look a lot like the role that he was very successful in his freshman year, as opposed to, you know, again, the number of players that you could name is large of guys who didn't quite figure any of that out when they needed to and ended up just, you know, the example I always use is Jimmer Fredette of, you know, if he'd been more willing to be a role player, he might have been able to carve out a decade-long NBA career. And he's been a very successful player overseas playing the exact role that he played in college, but yep. his NBA career wasn't quite that because he wasn't willing to make that adjustment.
Yeah, and he even made a second attempt at it, you know, later with a little bit, you know, more age and you would hope maturity and things. Not that I'm slamming his maturity at all, but, you know, one of the things that you think about with older players as they, you know, especially if they have success overseas and they come in, they typically are really good at a skill that an NBA team is like, okay, if we can use this, right? I look at it, you know, PJ Tucker or Patrick Beverley, for example, right? A very defined role that they could fill. Jimmer tried to come back and just really didn't do it, man. And again, it's not a knock on him. It's just you can be successful overseas. Stephon Marbury is another one of those types of players, right? Like he's a legend overseas. But back to the Peyton Sanford thing, and I've mentioned this every time we talk about it, Nick. It's like what makes players that are successful role players successful is that they were the stars on their team, and therefore they know what the star needs from them because they themselves needed it from others, right? So that experience is pretty scalable, and it's been pretty proven no matter what era of NBA that you go back and look at. You know, I mean, everybody was the man at some point, at a previous point in the NBA, and that's what we're seeing from Peyton. And what I like about him is that he's very dominant at what he does. He was very clearly Iowa's best player, but it didn't really feel like it stunted anybody else around him either. So even in his star level, he didn't really inhibit the play of anybody else. And I think that kind of speaks more to what he could look like into more of a connective role. And, you know, Nick, before we even hit play or record on this podcast, we were talking about, you know, maybe he could be a Sam Hauser type of player for the yeah. Boston Celtics. And Sam Hauser's talking about getting a contract extension right now because he's filling a very valuable role for a very good team, you know. And we talked about a certain player who I guess will not be named by me. I'll let you do that, who once upon a time was drafted pretty high for the Kings and it didn't really work out. But and he's an example. Nick Stauskas, I'll go ahead and break the seal.
I was going to make the Stauskas yeah. joke, but okay.
Yeah. Sure. So fine. Nick Stauskas is one of those dudes that didn't really get the opportunity because of how accelerated he was into the NBA. He was one of those guys, Nick, that you talked about earlier, is that he didn't know how to be a role player because he didn't really yet need to be one. Whereas Sam Hauser had, you know, these upperclassmen, they typically have to fight and earn their status on a team, as Peyton Sanford did, right? Like, he had to fight and earn and work his way up into that role. And I think that's what makes those types of players successful.
So speaking of what makes these players successful, let's talk about the stuff that Peyton Sanford did best. And I would say that that was the offense just generally, but, you know, we'll get into the specifics. And the biggest thing is his work in the half court, where, as you mentioned in the piece, he's in the 96th percentile. It's very hard to do much better than the 96th percentile, but he was even better as a spot up player, where he was in the 98th percentile. Right. And that, I think, is the story with Peyton Sanford, is, you know, as you mentioned, the, you know, Sam Hauser ideal, but the concept here being, this is a dude with wing size at the very minimum, right? You mentioned 2 through 4, like, even if, you know, and we'll get into the defense later, certainly, but, you know, even if he ends up being not, you know, someone who can guard fours all that effectively, like, he has size on the wing. You know, 2-3 is something that'll be, you know, very easy for him. He has more than enough size to take either of those spots. And then
it's on the table. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And then the question, you know, from there becomes, what, you know, how does he get to that ridiculously high level of efficiency offensively? And, you know, a lot of it is what we mentioned of being an incredibly elite 3-point shooter who, you know, also can do things with the ball in his hands. You know, maybe not someone you want to have running your offense, right? But also not someone who, you know, the example I use all the time is Troy Daniels of, okay, you know, elite of the elite shooter. And I think last time I brought up Troy Daniels, you mentioned Anthony Morrow, who's another perfect example, right? Of,
yeah, Jason Capono is a big favorite of mine. I feel like I need to give that man royalty. Not that I need to, but I'm sure he's fine. But, you know, he's my example of, like, the I am only a shooter. Please do not ask me to do something else.
Yeah, and I think, you know, the important thing with Sanford is that's not the case, right? You can ask him to do other things. You know, we'll get into the decision making in more detail in a moment, but, you know, it's someone who, okay, if the ball is in his hands, I trust that he's going to do something smart with it, whether that's pulling up immediately or moving the ball along to a teammate or pump faking and then trying to drive. He'll do something that makes sense in a way that, you know, when you're talking about a role playing shooter, that's really what you need, right? If he's forced off the line, can he do something? If he's forced to make a pass, can he make that pass? And, you know, with Sanford, again, the foundation of the shot is very strong. But as we've talked about, you need more than that. And thankfully, he has more than that to his game.
Yeah, he really does. And I think, you know, we talked about the shooting. He can do it in a number of ways, right? Like, obviously very good on the catch and shoot. He's good at movement plays. I mean, anytime that it felt like anytime Iowa had a out of bounds play, whether it be, you know, sideline or baseline, whatever the case may be, Iowa got very creative in how they wanted to get him the ball, and he could hit it in clutch. He could hit it on movement, like all those different things. But the area that I was kind of pleasantly surprised by, Nick, was the decision making, because you're not asking him to go out there and be Kyrie Irving with the ball in his hand, right? Like, that, I think that's, you don't really ask that of a lot of people, right? Obviously, a little bit of a straw man there on my part, but, you know, I'll allow myself to do that. But you do trust him. Yes, I'm very gracious to myself. Very humble, very humble. But you do trust him to make the, what we often refer to as, Nick, as the next pass, you know, like finding the open player. He can even do it not being stationary, which is a big thing. You know, one of the best things that a competent shooter in the NBA can do, Nick, is utilize their shot as a threat to freeze the defense or get their defender up in the air, right? Because then you get into kind of like that second level of the defense, and that's where, you know, gravity can turn into pressure. That's where you can kind of like pull players away and help your teammates out. Now, you probably don't want him getting super creative with the ball in his hands, right? To where he's like taking guys off of a crossover or behind the back or whatever. But if he can utilize that shot to make the defense hesitate just moments, because, Nick, I know that you talk about the NBA game and how it speeds up from college to the pros. He can slow the game down in the best ways possible because he is such a great shooter. And that opens up that playmaking aspect of his game, which I felt like, and you could see it too in the numbers and in the film, that he did utilize his playmaking a lot more this season being the star player at Iowa.
I think that's a really important point to hit, where, you know, again, the concept of the connective passer, as you say in the piece, is, I think, really what you would aim for Sanford, right? Because, again, the idea of him is, as you said, not someone who's going to have the ball in his hands every possession, right? But it's the concept of, you know, again, what can you do when the ball does swing your way? And, you know, having a good pump fake is something that, you know, turns good NBA players into great ones and turns great ones into Dwayne Wade, right? Just, you know, the concept of, okay, I can make a defender uncomfortable, right? And you mentioned the speed, and I think that's a huge part of it as well. I mean, you know, I don't remember what the exact numbers were at the moment off the top of my head, but it was seemed fascinating and very important to me that when I think it was P3 did a whole bunch of, you know, metrics measurements with NBA players. And, you know, one of the conclusions that I found the most fascinating was Luka Doncic and James Harden are not the fastest players in the league, and they're not thought of as the fastest players in the league. But when it comes to decelerating, they were among the elite of the elite. And that, I think, is really the big thing of it doesn't necessarily have to be you're playing at top speed. It's more about you're changing speeds enough to throw off a defense. And that can be something you do by being as fast as De'Aaron Fox. And that could be something that you do by pump faking and freezing the defender like Peyton Sanford.
Yeah. You mean, or what Shea does, like these kind of ball handlers that can get a little quirky with their dribble, or a Tyrese Halliburton, you know, these guys that have a cadence unto themselves. And one thing that makes NBA players, they're almost impossible to not see, like, who stands out, you know, as in terms of like, okay, this player is going to be good in the league, because they have their own look and feel. Like, they kind of, they set a standard in which other players oftentimes try to follow and imitate, but you can see where the difference is in terms of level of skill. You know what I mean? Like, each good player has like their own feel and aura to themselves, right? And I'm not saying that Sanford is one of these. He's probably a mimic of a lot of other successful players, but he's a pretty daggum good mimic of a, you know, the better 3-point shooters that the game has ever seen. And that's saying a lot. And, you know, going back to the speed of the game, one of the best ways that you can slow the game down is to make the defense slow down themselves. And utilizing a pump fake for a deadly 3-point shooter, like, that's going to cause defenses to panic a little bit. It's like giving the ball to Nikola Jokic at the elbow, right? It's like, okay, we really got to like be on our game right now, because we're in a spot that we know that Jokic is going to pick us apart. We just kind of have to make his life as hard as possible in doing so.
Yeah, it's funny because, you know, you bring up Shea, who's obviously the top line example of that. But for me, I think, you know, the player that most defined that sort of idea for me was Caris LeVert, of someone who he just doesn't quite dribble at the same speed as everybody else. And maybe it looks a bit funky when he does that, but it gets the job done, the job being throwing the defender off enough to get him room for a shot. And, you know, LeVert's had ups and downs, certainly throughout his NBA career, but just, you know, purely in terms of the fact that he was drafted 20th overall and has started in multiple spots and is still around, you know, playing a significant role for a playoff team in Cleveland. Like, yeah, you know, you don't have to be the Shea Gilgeous-Alexander of the world for that ability to sort of throw teams off with your rhythm being a huge plus for you. You know, you can be someone like a Caris LeVert, who's maybe further down the ladder, but someone who, you know, if Peyton Sanford can be Caris LeVert, then, you know, where he's going to end up getting drafted is probably going to look even more distant from where he theoretically should have been drafted, because, you know, getting Caris LeVert at 20 is a steal. Getting Caris LeVert at like 50 is like team defining kind of steal.
Yeah. I mean, that's what puts you in like executive of the year conversations, things like that, right? Is being able to clearly identify a talent and picking them up late in the draft. We see it pretty often.
So let's move on to the defensive side of things. And this, I think, is going to be the problem spot is not the way of putting it, but I think the best way for me to put it is his NBA career, I think, is going to be made on the defensive end, where the offense, I'm comfortable enough, he'll be able to, you know, fulfill at a high enough level. And then the question becomes, okay, can he, you know, he'll earn the playing time with his offense. Can his defense be solid enough to maintain that play
to sustain it? Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. It's going to be, we see this all the time. And I talked about this with Maxwell on the last show. It's like we get so caught up in like the idea of a 3-and-D player. And one of the things that you see 6'7", boom, he's wing size. Okay, 3-and-D. Like that's what we want, right? But we see so often that the 3-and-D, it's really 3 or D, right? And then we try to build that prospect up on the other side where, you know, 3-and-D is like, okay, a player like Peyton Sanford, for example, is like, if we could just get him to be respectable on that side, we're looking at a really good player. I mean, if he can grow to be a respectable NBA player, you're talking about a guy who should probably be taken in the top 20, maybe even the lottery. Like if you got a guy who's a guaranteed shooter and is like, let's say league average defender, he's going to be like redraft steal. Like we see this all the time. Or if you look at a, you know, like a, let's say Ryan Dunn, right? Elite collegiate defender. Elite.
Ridiculous. Ridiculous. Yeah. Defender.
If he can out, we always, I feel like we as a draft community, we kind of like oversimplify how easy or how difficult it is to be like a 36% 3-point shooter for like just your average college player, which is still a really good player compared to the rest of the world, right? We oversimplify like, oh, if he could just be 35%. Like if you can guarantee me right now that Ryan Dunn will shoot 33% from three in the NBA, Nick, I'm taking that guy in the lottery.
Yeah, I'm like, taking a top seven. If you can guarantee that for Ryan Dunn.
Yeah. And then if he gets any higher than that, that's just icing on the cake, right? So I think that we oversimplify it and we oversimplify the 3-and-D role. You know, it's like, oh, well, if all he has to work on, he's such a hard worker. You know, he's got great attitude. He dives after loose balls. He's in the gym all the time working on a shot. I'm just going to trust that this guy is going to develop into a 3-point shooter. And we don't see it. You know what I mean? Like it happens all the time. And that's going to be the thing with Peyton Sanford is like, if we can just get him to be a respectable defensive player, like if he can just not kill us on the defensive side of the ball, then we have a really good player. Now, and there's examples, Nick, in the film in which he has some good defensive footage. Like I include one where he sticks with Coleman Hawkins, who in a lot of people's eyes is a second round pick, right? He did a pretty good job in the play that I used where he stuck with him. And then you look at the next play where he's guarding Arthur Kaluma, who we talk about like players who were like sub players of like these archetypical roles. Arthur Kaluma is not going to be like a giant wing creator in the NBA. He's just not, right? But in college, he does a pretty good job. And we saw Peyton defend him in this particular play. And Kaluma just says, excuse me, on his way to the lane, right? And then I see Peyton guards Zach Hicks on a, like, kind of getting to the paint, counter move, contests the shot, forces a miss. And then I see him guard Terrence Shannon Jr., who some people have as a second-round player. And Terrence just, like, makes him look silly, just on a snatchback dribble into a three, right? And that's really where the – that's really, like, how you mentioned. You said it perfectly. That's going to be how Peyton Sanford sustains an NBA career, is if he can be more like those plays that we saw against Zach Hicks and – Coleman Hawkins, as opposed to the ones that we saw versus Terrence Shannon Jr. and Arthur Kaluma, both of whom are far more athletically gifted than the aforementioned two that we talked about.
Yeah, I do want to circle back to a point that you made a little bit earlier, because I think it's incredibly important to hammer home of people, you know, again, this is a bit of a straw man, but I think it's relevant to the point. You know, people will sort of assume there's always the, oh, if only he could shoot. Oh, if only he could shoot, right? And the number of players who, you know, actually fulfill the sort of Kawhi Leonard promise of this guy was an exceptional defender, but he couldn't shoot. All of a sudden, you know, he gets to the NBA and basically immediately becomes like a 40% 3-point shooter. Like that is the exception that proves the rule. And I think a lot of people just assume that it's, oh, you know, sometimes you end up like Kawhi Leonard and sometimes you end up like, I don't know, Hamidou Diallo, right? Like, That's not the entirety of, you know, how this works. It's not a binary outcome of, okay, some guys learn to shoot at the next level and some guys don't, right? The reality of it is like, okay, you know, 85% of these players will improve somewhat as a shooter, but if the baseline was low enough, improving somewhat as a shooter doesn't get them to the point where, you know, they're a 30% three-point shooter, much less 35, 36% three-point shooter. And, you know, for some guys, the difference between the college line and the NBA line takes a bit of time to adjust to. But for some guys, it's just, I'm comfortable in the 18 to 20 foot range. And if you push me out an extra three feet, I'm going to miss every time. Right. It's the kind of thing where I think there's this assumption that, oh, you know, it's just, and I think it's with shooting in particular that people tend to make this mistake, because it's like, oh, just lock yourself in the gym for 3 months. Like, if you don't lock yourself in the gym for 3 months and improve your shot, then you don't care about basketball. And it's like, it doesn't work like that, right? Like, we say all the time, development isn't linear, and we say that for a reason, because guess what? It isn't. But also, more to the point, I think there's sort of this, you know, and it's almost a psychological element of, well, you know, I can't give myself a 40-inch vertical and I can't grow to 6'9", but I can lock myself in a gym for 3 months and stand at the free throw line until I improve as a free throw shooter, right? It's like, there are so many elements that go into this, but I think shooting is one in particular that people can convince themselves is a lot easier to develop than other skills, because it doesn't require you having a 40-inch vertical. It doesn't require you, you know, having the physical strength to just knock someone around in the post, right? It's just, hey, if you spend enough hours on it, you'll eventually figure it out, right? It's the sort of the fallacy of the other side of the 10,000 hours theory of, like, just because you spend all that time doing it, it's not like these guys weren't working on their shot anyway, right? It's not like Ryan Dunn has never taken a jump shot in practice and that's why he can't shoot well from 3-point range. It's something that I think is a particular issue with shooting, where people think it's a lot easier to develop than it is, because it's a lot easier to see random person off the street, you know, take a whole bunch of shots and eventually develop into a shooter, than it is to say, hey, random 5'9" guy off the street, you're going to be dunking in 3 weeks.
And so, again, you know, back to this philosophy thing, like, even if you do improve as a 3-point shooter, then you got to deal with what I'm probably going to call the Isaac Okoro theory, where let's say he does get to be a respectable, you know, 35% 3-point shooter, like somewhere in that neighborhood, let's say 34 to 36, right? Just keep it open. Then you got to deal with, are defenses going to care that you hit 34 to 36% if you're only going to take one or two of those a game? Like, okay, we're going to gamble that we give Isaac Okoro his 3 points on this one shot if we can sell out on the people around you, right? And absolutely. Then back into more philosophy is like, okay, if Peyton Sanford is such a defensive liability, it doesn't matter how good he could shoot, he's not going to see the floor. Is the team that drafted him going to invest the time to make that 38% worth it? Or are they going to trade for a guy? You know what I mean? And then for these defenders, like, what lineups do I have that I can afford for your awesome defense to impact my spacing? You know what I mean? So that's where these things like really inhibit. And as much as we can like drool over the idea of players, you know, those are all variables that Peyton Sanford can't even answer yet, because he's not even on an NBA team, let alone the 30 that are going to have the opportunity to take him. And then how much playing time is he going to get out of the other 449 players that are going to be on NBA rosters, let alone the two-way contracts and exhibit 10s? You know, it's all a numbers game.
Yeah, I think that's really the way to put it, is like, look, you have to have, you know, I say this on here all the time, avenues to playing time, right? What is it that is going to earn you? It's not just earning you minutes in a vacuum. It's earning you minutes over the 14 other rostered players on the team you are going to, right? And so, you know, there's sort of the obvious first level of different teams need different things, right? The Orlando Magic need shooting a lot more than, you know, the Boston Celtics, just because that's how their teams are built, right? Like, Orlando was dead last in 3-point shooting for the vast majority of the season, and they had to get hot late in the season to climb up to, I think they ended up at like 24th, right? It's like, that's
not
a
drafted team. And they drafted Jet Howard, and how much has he played? You know, not what much. I mean?
Yeah,
exactly.
But yeah, you know, that's a whole thing of the calculus of the avenues to playing time are going to be different on different teams. But, you know, I do want to circle back to Sanford in specific here, because, you know, again, I think as you brought up, it's not that the defense is non-existent. Like, you know, I hate doing this kind of negative example thing, but I think it's relevant here of like, look, there are just so many blocks in the way of Max Avemus ever becoming like an acceptable defensive player, right? You know, and Sanford has the biggest one going for him in the most obvious way possible. He's 6'7". He's not 6 foot, right? And so that alone, you know, opens a lot of defensive avenues for him. But also, as you mentioned, you know, he's got decent length. He's not, you know, he's not someone who doesn't put in effort on the defensive end at all, which is, you know, I think he could stand to put in more effort defensively, but it's also the same sort of calculus of if you're the star player offensively, you have less effort on the defensive end of the floor just because, hey, you're a human being and you only have so much stamina, right? Even for the elite of the elite athletes. But with Sanford, I think, you know, again, there are building blocks, as you mentioned there, defensively. You know, does he get to the point where he's comfortably below average defensively and good enough offensively to earn playing time? I think that's a very clear, obvious outcome for him. Do I think he ever becomes better than, you know, average defensively? It's a bit of a harder climb, I think. But again, you know, it's not like he's starting from nothing. Like, there are some players who, when you're talking about the defensive concept for them, it's like, oh boy, who does he ever defend, right? And with Sanford, it's like, there are places you can hide him. He's big enough that you don't feel too uncomfortable throwing him on a three. And then the question just becomes, okay, you know, can he work on the things that he can develop enough? You know, can he work on his technique? Because maybe he's not going to, again, be that, you know, ridiculous elite of the elite athlete, because that's, you know, a bit harder to get significantly better at when you get to the NBA level, right? But there are enough things that he can do, and he does have enough of a foundation that even though there's a road ahead of him to climb, it's not out of the question for me that he, again, at least gets to that sort of comfortable below average point defensively where the offense outweighs the defense enough to earn him significant minutes.
Exactly. And it goes again to, does the team have the defensive infrastructure? Do they have the schematic advantage? You know, is the coach that he's going to play for? Does he have a proven track record, or does the organization have a proven track record of hiding players with defensive liabilities? You know, we mentioned Sam Hauser earlier for the Boston Celtics. They did the same thing with, you know, probably the greatest Sacramento King in recent history, Isaiah Thomas, who is now going to be playing with the Phoenix Suns again. You know, did a phenomenal job of hiding Isaiah Thomas on that defense and helping him be on MVP ballots, right? So if Peyton can go to a team that has proven track record of being able to hide defensive liabilities, even if it's just for regular season, even if Peyton doesn't play in the playoffs but has a successful multi-year career, like, that's still a player that you draft, especially in these, you know, what the consensus is saying is like a historically weak draft class, then you still take a guy like this, you know, according to, you know, picking a guy with the NBA skill philosophy, right? So that's, again, it's a very nuanced and very, you know, ambiguous way of saying that Peyton Sanford should be on draft radars this year, like, easily, because you're talking about one of, if not the best shooter in this entire draft class with good size, and that defense does have an upward trajectory of improving, you know? So you do have a guy who you trust to continue to work to improve in those areas based on his history of continuous improvement, you know? So those are all positives, all upticks, and obviously good character guy. He's going to be one of these guys, Nick, that's going to get a cup of coffee in the NBA. It's just, how is he going to do it? And if you know that this guy is going to play in the NBA, why would you not want to draft this guy?
That's, I think, the big question, which ultimately, you know, in a way sort of wraps up the production versus potential debate of, look, the number of players that actually have long-term NBA careers out of any draft class, much less a draft class that's seen as relatively weak, it's a lot smaller than you think. Like, by the time you get to even picking in the 20s, you know, there'll be almost as many guys who don't make a second contract as there are guys who have long-term NBA careers. And so when you're talking about someone like Sanford, who, you know, realistically speaking, he's probably going to go in the second round if he's drafted.
Yeah.
Like, the number of players that even make an NBA roster for, again, more than a cup of coffee out of the second round of the draft is a lot smaller than people think it is. And, you know, you officially completed the sucking up trio for, you know, getting Isaiah Thomas mentioned in there. So I do appreciate that. But, you know, Isaiah Thomas
was picked in the second round, by the way.
Picked exactly the last pick of the draft.
Mr. Irrelevant, yeah.
That's yep. Right. And he was very not irrelevant, and he's still playing, which, you know, makes me extraordinarily happy. But that's a different point. The point I'm trying to make with Sanford here is the number of players who get any sort of playing time at all out of being a second round pick is vanishingly small. And so if you can get someone like Sanford with, you know, I'm just going to pick a random example out of thin air. If you get him with the 47th pick, sure, and you think, all right, this is a guy who will be our 11th man during the regular season who doesn't play during the playoffs, that is a much higher bar than the vast majority of 47th picks in NBA history ever clear. And, you know, I don't know off the top of my head if there's a specific 47th pick who was an all-star, all-NBA guy. Like, I do, in fact, know that there is with the 60th pick, but the concept there, I think, is the same of, look, if you think that he's got a clear NBA skill as a shooter and he does enough else offensively that you're not worried about, you know, him being an issue out there, then, you know, that is such a good pickup, you know, late in the second round in any year, but particularly in a year like this one where people are unsure of just how many NBA caliber players there are and just how strong the top of the draft is. You know, as you mentioned, there's a lot of reason to draft Sanford because he has that incredibly high foundation on the offensive end. And if he doesn't figure it out on the defensive end, then you know what? If given where he's likely to get drafted, that's not, you know, that's not a big loss. But if he can figure out enough on the defensive end, then you're talking about someone who could be a steal anywhere from late in the first round to where he's probably likely to get picked in the second.
Yeah, you're talking about one of these theoretical should have been taken higher guys, you know. And again, the going back to the draft philosophy, you know, second round, do you take, is that where you take swings? Or if you have multiple second round picks, you know, how many swings do you take, you know? Or do you just say, like how you just said, Nick, like, well, second, the thing that I can't stand philosophy wise is that second round picks don't matter, just trade them away, sell them off, or just swing for the fences. You know, I'm definitely more happy with the swing for the fences as opposed to just flat out saying that second round picks don't matter. That's been a proven fallacy, right? And Peyton is just going to be like a number of other prospects in this class, Nick, that have skill, that do have avenues. It just might not be as many, and he's going to be kind of like a product of, you know, situation, right? Like there's 30 teams. I don't know off the top of my head, I'm putting myself in a bad spot, how many teams do or don't have a pick this year, right? But let's say a good 25 of them, to be safe, do, right? It depends on how many. It depends on roster construction. It depends on how warm the gentleman's seat is that's picking this year, right? Like, he's going to be a player that's subject to all of those variables, just like everybody else. But it all goes back to the original thing that we were talking about. If this draft class is so weak and you have a guy who not only has like one of the, like probably the best shooter in this class, but does have like the pedigree to at least see an NBA court, even if it's just for 5 minutes in his entire NBA career, right? Why are you not taking that guy at all in a draft? And that's what I think the argument is at minimum. I've kind of gone more on the conservative end. Nick, there's a possibility that you got Duncan Robinson sitting right in front of you, right? And Peyton Sanford. And that man has had playoff success. That man has had contractual success. He has, you know, played alongside some of the best players in the entire NBA, right? And you draft Duncan Robinson in the first round, no matter what year it is, because of the path that he has had to success, right? Peyton Sanford could definitely be this guy, right? It depends on so much. And that's where you're going to come to, that's where it comes down to how do you help actualize the potential that he has in his production.
I don't think we could end at a better place than that, but just in case, anything else you want to mention here before we wrap this one up?
No, man, Nick, I just want to continue to give you your flowers and make you so, so uncomfortable with my kind words. Nick, you're just so humble. And one thing, a saying that I think applies to you is like, there's no I in team, but there are two I's in humility, and that's how humble you are, right? Because you get both I's. So thanks again, man, for having me. I'm loving being back, man. I had a lot of fun with you.
I am very glad that this is not on video so people cannot see how aggressively red my face is right now.
It matches the red Yankees hat that I'm wearing.
There we go. There we go. Go Yankees. I can't close any better than that.
Well, I wear it because it's an homage to Fred Durst and Limp Bizkit. Not that I'm a baseball fan at all, but
we can cut that part out. You're a lifelong Yankees fan just like me. It's fine.
Yes, and you're a Limp Bizkit fan just like everybody else in the world.
Perfect. All right, so he is Stephen Glaspie. You can find him on Twitter at Stephen G Hoops, and you can, of course, find his written work on NoCeilingsNBA.com in addition to the Peyton Sanford piece that we talked about today. You can find me on Twitter at NBA Johnson, and you can find my written work on NoCeilingsNBA.com as well. If you've been enjoying the show, please take the time to leave a rating and or a review in whatever podcast player you might be using. That's always much appreciated on our end. And if you have any feedback regarding the deep dive specific portion of the podcast, feel free to reach out to me either via Twitter or email nickaj.nba@gmail.com. And as always, thanks so much for listening.